Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's programme, we'll be looking at how memories are formed in one of the cutest experiments we've had on the programme in quite some time. We kick off the show looking back at some of the breaking stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Fergus McAuliffe of iCraig and Dr. Shane Bergen of UCD to discuss the week's happenings. You're both very welcome. Shane, our first story is a pretty cool one. It has to do with planets aligning.
Yes, Jonathan. In history, celestial, kind of rare celestial events like supernovae or planets aligning would have always been sort of associated with ominous events. So I'll leave the listeners to determine which ominous event in the last week they would like to associate with the actual alignments of planets in the night sky. So over the coming weeks, listeners will be able to look to the horizon, right, just as the sun is setting, ideally around half an hour after the sun is setting, and they'll see a planetary parade. They'll be able to see Mars, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. Four of them are visible to the naked eye, and the other two, Uranus and Neptune, you'll need a telescope. But it is pretty amazing to think that you could go out on a clear evening, when we're not during a red alert, hopefully, and you'll be able to see those planets on the horizon. You'll see Venus and Saturn in the southwest, Jupiter in the southeast, and Mars in the east. And of course, the closest ones are brightest. Venus is really visible. It's extremely bright because it's covered in cloud. And so the sunlight that reflects off it is incredibly bright. And Mars looks like somewhat like a red light bulb. The other two are just tiny dots. But they do look distinguished. It's easy to distinguish them from a star. Stars.
How do you do that? Because I've looked in the sky and gone, that must be a planet. Because that doesn't. But I don't know what it is.
Well,
I feel like it's an aura.
Might be.
Planetary aura. No, but how is it easy to tell them?
Well, they look a little bit bigger is one thing, right? And another is that they don't move across the night sky in the same way. But sure, that's no good to you unless you're standing there for ages, right? So they look more like sort of coloured in circles, right? As opposed to tiny points of light. Mm. So they are a little fatter on the night sky than a star.
Yeah.
Of course, stars have different colours too, but Mars in particular will have that nice red hue to it.
It took me actually quite a long time to recognise the planet that's missing, which is Mercury.
Yes.
And that, I suppose, having all of the planets align in the night sky is a very, very rare event. How rare is this one?
It's pretty rare, but not extremely rare. And it's not extremely rare because of how the planets were formed. So all of the planets orbit the sun in something called the ecliptical, right, which is an imaginary line in space that basically we're all on the same level, as it were. And that's because when the solar system was formed, there was lots of dust that was left over that didn't join the star in the middle of the sun. And that dust clumped together to form the planets.
Various distances apart from the sun.
Yeah, exactly.
So they sort of clumped together and created planets along this same plane.
Exactly. So therefore, when you look out into the night sky, you can kind of see that plane, right, that all of the planets move along. And so it's not unusual for them to be lined up. Like the last time it happened was only a couple of years ago. But it's pretty amazing that you can go out and look at them, and that like for all of them bar two, you don't need a telescope. I think that's really cool. Like, have you ever seen the planet Jupiter or Saturn through a telescope?
No.
Really?
No.
Oh, well, I think you and the show need to make your way out to...
We should do a little thing. I always say we should do a little event, but then like I think, oh, what if I'm tired?
Well, Fergus and I'll go. let you know what it's like. But it is amazing.
No, I absolutely think we should do a nighttime thing. Astronomy Week is coming up. Maybe we'll hatch some plan. I was really fascinated to see how planets are actually moving through space, though, because we often think of planets, because we're very heliocentric. We think that the sun is the center of everything because we rotate around it. But of course, the sun itself is also rotating and traveling through the galaxy. So if you ever look at that, there's a video that shows that as the sun moves through space, it's actually sort of a corkscrew thing.
That's right.
Where it's traveling through a column or a ring itself, and so it's not really round and round. It's actually sort of a spiral in which we all
it was the
orbit
only
around the
part
sun.
Of, well, not the only. It was one of the parts of my undergraduate physics that broke me, was trying to understand how planetary motion and all of these things, because there's nothing stationary.
Yeah,
there's no fixed point, and you can say everything goes around. You know, so like. You have to.
You can't observe anything from one point because you're that point is always moving through
moving,
space.
Yeah.
Do you know what it made me realize though? All of those time travel science fiction movies that we watch, they're complete real nonsense. Because if you go back in time, even just a couple of hours, you'll be thousands of miles away from where you were and die instantly in the oxygen.
That's a really good point.
Both time and space travel.
Well, I think you should be one of those people at the next science fiction conference that puts their hand up and goes, excuse
Ferg
me.
that's my dream. Dr. Fergus McCullough, thanks for coming in. Haven't seen you in a while. Your story has to do with men and women. And you're a perfect example of this particular study.
Yeah. So it's all to do with men's height and weight. So over the past century, it appears that men have grown twice as much as women. So this is actually a really nice study out of the University of Roehampton. And what they did is they used enormous data sets from the World Health Organization. And those data sets had information on men and women's height and weight. They then compared that to something called the Human Development Index, which is a measure that incorporates a few different things, but has things like your life expectancy, your time in education, your per capita income, and it's a score between 0 and 1. The closer you are to 1, the higher the Human Development Index in that country. And what they found was
sort of third world countries that would have lower ones.
Would have lower.
Advanced ones with great systems and access to nutrition and quality of life, they would have higher, closer to 1.
Exactly, right. Yeah. So for reference, the UK is about 0.9 on that index. So what they found was that as the living conditions have improved over the last century, both height and weight increase for men and women, as you would expect. But it's twice as fast for men as it is in women. So I'll give you an example of that. If you go back to 1905, about 1 in 4 women born in the UK was taller than the average man. Fast forward 50 years, that is now about 1 in 8 women taller than the average man. So it's actually happening quite fast.
I mean, you would have been a freak back then.
I would have been a freak.
You're six foot four. You would have been like, they would have had you in a carnival.
Yeah, I would have been like, I don't know, giant man or something like. But why is this? It's all down to a phenomenon called sexual size dimorphism. And we see that a lot in nature. So if you think, say, for instance, an elephant seal, a male is 10 times bigger than a female. But it's not always like that.
Is it?
Yeah.
10 times?
It can be up to 10 times bigger.
Blimey.
On the flip side, you look at octopuses, often the females are way bigger than the males. There's one particular one called the blanket octopus. The female is 40,000 times bigger than the male. So I have no idea how the reproduction there works.
Disappointing, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Disappointing.
Yeah. But in humans, I guess one of the reasons this particular article has gained so much traction is that the article itself is called The Sexy and Formidable Male Body.
Right.
And we've known for a while that women want taller men more than men want shorter women.
Carry on now, Fergus.
I wanted to make sure that I said the right. So
according to psychological research.
Yeah. Yes. According to psychological research, in terms of how people perceive their own height and the height of their partner. So the take home message, I think. From all of this is that as the environment becomes more rich and more greater access to food and healthcare, that appears to favour men more, because it appears that they live less sort of energy expenditure in their life. So one of the big constraints on this, and it's ecologically constrained, is that because of the demands of reproduction and pregnancy, it is harder for women to use the same available resources over time.
Baron Trump, I learned today, is 6'9". I don't know, that doesn't say anything to it, but what an extraordinary height. Our third story has to do with dark oxygen.
Yeah, which is not a thing, but it's pretty cool, right? So oxygen comes... Oxygen's a vicious little element. It wants to grab things, and it's why it's part of the fire triangle, etc. Last year in Nature Geoscience, there was an incredible finding published, which said that metals that had precipitated out of seawater at the bottom of the ocean were actually set up in such a way as to act like batteries that had lithium and things in them. And they were able to crack the seawater using a process called electrolysis and create oxygen. That's incredible, because we thought that nearly all the oxygen on the Earth was created through photosynthesis. So the idea that there would be oxygen created at the bottom of an ocean is remarkable, because it might mean that life could have taken hold down there in a way that was entirely independent from the photosynthesis driven world on the surface. And there's two or three very interesting things that have happened in the meantime. The first is that NASA are very interested in this finding, and they've been talking with the researchers that led the initial study, because there's implications for how we might look for life on other planets and exoplanets. So there may have been, there may be like rich life at the bottom of the ocean. There are others, because people want to mine these precious metals at the bottom of the ocean.
Of course they do.
And now that we know that it may be...
I can think of one person in particular.
Yeah, exactly. Rich biosphere. There are many scientists who are saying, hold on a minute, don't go down there with your big scraper digging up all those precious metals, because we need to understand what's happening down there. Mm. It's a tricky one, because our energy transition requires critical raw materials like lithium. In other words, if we're going to move away from a world that's driven by oil, we need batteries. And so it's very, very tricky. Very, very tricky indeed. No, more on this, no doubt.
Very good. Our final story, Fergus. Peeing is contagious.
Yes.
Some animals.
I think this is my favourite story of the year already. So the question is, do chimps who urinate together stay together? This was carried out in Japan, which is actually the perfect country for a study like this, because in Japanese they have a word, tsureshon, which is a word that describes the act of going to the bathroom together in a group. They have a word for that,
right,
over in Japan. There was a research team. They spent 600 hours studying 20 captive chimpanzees, and they observed them peeing more than 1,300 times.
Okay.
Weird.
Now, what did they find? Is that chimps were likely to pee together if a chimp was near another chimp who was already peeing, kind of suggesting that the behavior is contagious. Now, I want to make kind of a distinction here. Like, if I was to laugh, the chances are you guys would also eventually start laughing. That is to do with like social norms and wanting to fit in. That appears not to apply in the case of chimps. It appears to be much more dependent on rank within the group. So a low-ranking chimpanzee needs to be much more vigilant because of its low rank. It is more likely to see a high-ranking chimpanzee urinating, and as a result, will also urinate as a result of that. So this particular research raises a lot of questions as to why chimps are urinating in groups in the first instance. It has led to a lot of speculation. I think probably the takeaway from this is that we need much more research on...
what, you're saying that observing chimpanzees go to the toilet 1,300 times is not enough data to figure anything out on whether or not, and we need to do more of that, do we?
Apparently so, but I think ultimately, if you leave the data out of it, there's a quote, an old Italian proverb, whoever doesn't pee in company is either a thief or a spy.
I like that. I like that. Thank you very much, Dr. Shane Berger from UCD and Dr. Fergus McCall from iCraig. This is an interesting one. Every once in a while you come across research that uses a really quirky methodology, and they're the ones that I think I love most on this program. New research from Cornell explains why new memories aren't overwriting old ones in mice using some teeny tiny technology. Antonio Fernando Ruiz is an assistant professor and Meinig family investigator at the Life Sciences Department of Neurology and Behavior at Cornell. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Antonio. Tell me, what has you interested in memory? Why is memory of interest to you?
Thank you, Jonathan. Understanding memory, I think, is one of the biggest mysteries that we face still. And it's very important for many reasons. One of them is because memory is part of our identity. Like who we are is basically shaped by our memories, our previous experiences. So that has been always a very fascinating thing to me to understand how it works at the level of the brain. And the other is because there are many diseases. And these days, there are increasing number of cases such as Alzheimer and dementia that are characterized by deficits in memory. So understanding how memory works in the brain will provide a way to treat these diseases in the future.
In this particular piece of research, one of the questions that we've been trying to grapple with in research and neuroscience is how memories are stored and don't interfere with each other. Can you just give me a bit of a background to this question, please?
Yeah, so something that has been difficult to understand for a very long time is how it's possible that our brains have a limited number of neurons, a limited number of brain cells, so they have a limited capacity. Even though we are able to learn new things over the extent of our whole lives, so since we are born, we are learning new things, we are experiencing new events, and all this information is registered in our brain. So how is possible that with the relatively limited capacity of our brain, our ability to learn seems endless? Mm. This problem is especially clear when you compare to computers, right? Because computers, despite their wondrous capabilities, they are limited in the kind of things they can learn and they can store. And they seem to be much more limited than humans.
Mm. Yeah, I was just thinking recently, I heard a song that I hadn't heard in ages, and I was reminded of the place I was when I used to listen to the song. I remember the lyrics and the tune, and I thought, God, there must be hundreds of thousands of sounds stored somewhere in my brain that I just recall, and they're attached to memories I haven't used in such a long time. The brain is a really amazing organ. In this particular bit of research, you were looking at mice, I'm wondering, before we talk about the methodology, which is really interesting, do we know how memories are stored in the brain fully yet? Have we fully figured that out? Because I know there are little packages that we seem to think might be stored somewhere, but getting down to where my memory of my grandmother making me banana sandwiches in the back garden when I was 8, where that is physically located in my brain, we don't really know that yet, do we?
So we know to some extent. We know as a general kind of principle that the memories are stored in the pattern of connections between cells in our brain. So when you learn something new, when you hear a new song, the connections between your brain cells will change ever so slightly, and those changes store the memory. So when you hear the song again, maybe 5 months later, that will make one of those brain cells to activate, and it will retrieve the whole memory. Because it's like this common feeling, like, oh, you just hear the first tune of a song and then you can retrieve the whole thing. That is because, let's say, the brain cell that was stored in the beginning of the song is connected to a network of other brain cells that store the whole song. So this pattern of connectivity across among our brain cells is what stores memory.
Mm. So it's not like a physical grain of rice that stores one specific thing is stored away in a locker somewhere.
Exactly. It's not like you cannot say this particular memory of my grandma telling me this story is stored in this one neuron or in this group of neurons. It's more in a distributed network.
Yeah.
Not so different as how it will be inside of a computer.
Okay, so let's talk about your research. You were using mice and you wanted to see the relationship between memory formation and sleep. What drove you in terms of designing this study, and what did you do?
Yeah, so we were very interested in what is the role of sleep in memory. And it has been known for a long time that sleeping makes our memories better. So if you, and maybe you have experienced this yourself, like, you know, you go to sleep, I mean, you study, spend the whole day studying, and then, you know, you don't sleep well enough. And by the next morning, when you have to go to, let's say, take an exam, you have forgotten half of what you study over the previous day. However, if you have a good night of sleep, typically that will make your memory stronger. It will make it long-lasting. So we were interested in how this happens. So what are the processes inside your brain that allow this capacity? And in particular, the fact that even if you are studying today, let's say something that is similar to a bunch of other things that you learned before, you not only want to remember what you study, but you want to remember in a way that you can differentiate from previous knowledge or from previous experience. So how our brain achieves that is the question that we set to investigate.
So you designed teeny tiny headsets for mice. Can you tell me about the methodology of this particular research and why you did that as opposed to what a lot of researchers tend to do, which is use electrodes to record activity directly from the brain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First of all, we study mice because they are easy to train and to work with. And the mechanisms of memory are very similar, we believe, to those of humans. And we did both. We have we implant them with electrodes in the brain. So we have like hundreds of very tiny electrodes, like thin needles, that go inside the brain and allow us to record the activity of hundreds of brain cells. And also we implant them with a headset with a camera. And the idea was that we wanted to record eye movements, because the eye moves during sleep, and the way it moves can tell us what stage of sleep the mice is in. And this is very similar to what happened with humans, or maybe you have seen it in small kids, or even you have pets. They do the same. Depending on which sleep stage they are in, their eyes may be still, or they may be moving quite fast, or the size of the pupil, if you can look at it, will be shrinking or expanding.
So so you're talking about different changes in REM sleep, which I think a lot of people might be familiar with, you know, your eyes going crazy around when you're in we're dreaming and so on. But you said the pupil, the size of the pupil, which is actually key to this study. How do you measure the size of a pupil with a mouse when they're asleep?
Yeah, right. So that was a bit of a surprising discovery. We knew, like as you said, like during REM sleep, it's a rapid eye movement sleep, our eyes move from left to right. And then during this deeper, slow wave sleep, our eyes are mostly still. But what we discovered with this study was that it is possible to look at the pupil, not only at the eye movement, but at the size of the pupil itself when the mouse goes to sleep, because they sleep with the eyes eyelid half open. Huh. So we can see the pupil. And the camera is very tiny, it's right in front of the eye. So we could record the pupil. And then we saw that the pupil size fluctuated between a very small and very large diameter.
So you have this headset on top of a mouse's head, and you have a teeny tiny camera looking at the eye movement and the pupil. And with this tiny camera, you can detect changes in the size of the pupil of the mouse that tells you something about what's happening with the mouse's REM sleep and memory formation. That's absolutely fascinating. So what did you find, and how do you test memory in this situation?
So the first thing that we found was that this stage of a deep sleep, the slow wave sleep, where we believe that memories are strengthened, was composed or could be divided in two different stages. In one of them, the pupil is very small, and in the other, the pupil is very large. So then we wonder, well, why is this? What is the function of this? And to test memory in mice, what we did was we trained them to find a little piece of reward that they like very sugary reward, on a maze. So every day we put the mouse on the maze, and we hide the reward in one area, and they have to find it. Mm. And they really like it, so they really make the best effort to find it. And after they find it, we can test a few hours later. We can test if they remember it. So we let them go to sleep, and at the end of the day, we put them in the maze again, and we see if they remember, they will go directly to the location where the sugary reward was. And if they don't remember, they will just wander around and try to find it again.
Ah, okay. So you wake up the mice. Is that the plan?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, they take a nap, and then we put them back in the maze.
And so, what does that teach you then? Because you can see whether or not a memory has been implanted and stays. How does that explain anything to do with older memories and newer memories?
Yeah. So what we found was that the mice was doing this task every day. So we could test at the end of the day. We could test if they remember the new location of the reward. But also, we could test if they remember the previous day location.
Huh.
So what we did to try to, mimic the situation where, there is something very familiar. You know how to go to work because you go every day, and maybe you learn how to go to any restaurant today. You know? So those are similar memories, but one of them is familiar and the other is new. So to mimic this situation, we train the mice for, let's say, 1 week, to go to always to the same location and come back and retrieve some sugary reward, and then to find a new one. So there were two locations, one familiar and one novel. And what happened during sleep was that the new memory, the new location, was that memory was formed during only the specific brain sleep state in which the pupil was the smallest. And then we wonder why would be that? Why only a very small part of the whole nap, like 20% of the sleep period, was the only part of sleep that was dedicated to make this new memory? And the reason we came up with was that when you learn something new, at the beginning is very unstable. No, your brain hasn't changed yet. Your brain cells hasn't consolidate this new memory, so it's very sensitive to interference. It can get mixed up with other memories. So you really need to dedicate a specific time of the night of the sleep in which your brain, the only thing that it does is consolidate, is strengthen this memory while suppressing other memories, other activity, and that happens when the pupil is small. So this is like a special protected state in which our brain is dedicated to strengthen the new experiences of the day. And then, in the rest of the sleep, you can do other things, right? The brain is activating the older memories, the new memories all together.
Right. So is this applicable to humans? What can this teach us about human learning, if anything? And do you think it could be useful? Because it's the first time we understood this. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So this is the first time we understood this, and we believe it's going to be very similar in humans. So humans also have different sleep stages. They also go through different phases of shallower and deeper sleep. And we believe that this structure, this temporal structure of sleep, is there to accomplish different functions. And for example, we have been talking about how do we strengthen new memories, how during sleep we can make memories of that day be stronger and be more stable. But there is also another function of sleep, which is making new ideas, new connections between experiences. And maybe Some people will be familiar with this feeling that, you know, you go to sleep thinking about a problem and then you wake up with a new solution, a new creative idea that you haven't thought before. And the reason why this could happen is because during sleep, by activating at the same time, you know, many stored knowledge, many different memories, new connections, new associations can appear. And these two functions are a little bit contradictory, right? In one case, you want to kind of shut down everything and only activate this one memory, this one new memory. And in the other case, you want to activate everything together, mix up, and try to come up with new connections. So the way the brain accomplishes these two functions is by separating them during sleep, in different phases of sleep.
Really cool research. It's been wonderful speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. That's Antonio Fernandez Ruiz from Cornell University. Thanks, Antonio.
Thank you, Jonathan.
That's it from us on this week's Future Proof. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan producing, Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.